From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. President Trump relishes a fight, and he picked a new one with his announcement that he would slap tariffs on imported metals. 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. Now, China is the target, but its allies such as Canada, Europe, and Mexico, and his own party, the GOP, who are up in arms. We're not backing down, says the president. Trade wars are good, he tweeted. This hour on Point, the president's new tariffs and the threat of a trade war. You can join us on air or online. What do you think? Is this a worthy fight? Are there real American jobs at stake? And can the president's tough talk on trade save them? Or will these tariffs cost more jobs than they save? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Sarah McGregor. She's U.S. economics editor for Bloomberg News, and she leads Bloomberg's coverage of trade policy. Sarah, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I just want to start off by reminding folks that it was last week when the president tweeted, when a country is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. But then yesterday, sitting in the Oval Office with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the president was peppered by reporters with questions about his recent statement that that trade wars are good. And President Trump seemed to pull back a little on that threat. Here's what he said.
I don't think you have a trade war. No trade war? I don't think so. I don't think you're going to have a trade war.
So, Sarah, where do we stand? Is a trade war looming?
So we got our hands on a report overnight from the European Union saying it's preparing to levy tariffs of 25% on some pretty iconic American goods. If anything says made in America, it's things like what it's targeting, Harley Davidson, Levi Strauss jeans, orange juice, and that's to the tune of $3.5 billion that they're looking at. And so I think a trade war is sort of a far-off prospect in some ways at this point, but countries are definitely drawing up plans right now about how they would react to these tariffs being imposed on steel and aluminum that could hurt key parts of their economy.
Right. So retaliatory levies is what we're looking at, possibly from the EU. Now, Harley, Levi's, Bourbon, you know, these are important products made by companies in the districts of Paul Ryan, Nancy Pelosi, and Mitch McConnell, respectively. So is this the EU trying to really erode support in Congress by targeting their levies like this?
Exactly. I mean, the pushback to this has been pretty fierce. We saw it first with the markets immediately after this impromptu announcement by Trump about the tariffs last week. And now we've seen it trickle down to allies. And it's actually quite remarkable, the fight that his own party is starting to put up against this right now. As you said, House Speaker Paul Ryan has broken from Trump on this issue and said it could hurt it'll be bad for the economy. It could spark a trade war. It could actually offset the gains from these sort of shiny new Republican tax cuts. And so it's, you know, he hasn't really broken with Trump on a lot of issues, even the most controversial ones during his presidency. So that's quite remarkable. And we see on other parts of the party that actually some senators are saying, you know, we might draw up some legislation to try and claw back Trump's power to unilaterally impose these tariffs. Under the law which this all started, the president actually does have the sole authority without having to even go through Congress to impose these tariffs. So I think Congress is starting to wake up to the fact that they need to see if they can put some checks and balances on this.
Right. So about Paul Ryan here, just yesterday, his spokesperson, Ashley Strong, said that to your point, the new tax reform law has boosted the economy, and we certainly don't want to jeopardize those gains, and that they're urging the White House not to advance with the tariff plans. Now, tell me more about some members of Congress saying that they might try to float legislation that would run in opposition to this 1962 law, I think, that the president's going to rely on to impose tariffs, right? This is the law that Congress passed that would allow the president to impose tariffs unilaterally in support of national security. So who's talking about perhaps new legislation?
So we have Senator John Cornyn from Texas saying that, you know, if these do go through, we need some hearings. We need to get a congressional and public debate going on about this. Kevin Brady from the House Ways and Means Committee, he was actually at talks in Mexico City that just ended over NAFTA. And, you know, he really sort of said he'd go to bat for Mexico and Canada on this. And him and a group of other lawmakers want to see if there can be exclusions for, let's say, a company can only access certain steel and aluminum products from abroad, not domestically source them. Maybe there could be exclusions to the tariffs from them.
That sounds like trying to thread the needle, though, on this, right?
Exactly. And I think it's a fair, a fair thing to point out at this stage. Trump actually hasn't signed the final order on these tariffs. So there's furious lobbying going on right now from lawmakers, from companies, from other nations. The Swedish prime minister's in town today. That was a planned visit, but you can be sure that he's going to be passing along the EU message. They're trying to get exclusions. They're trying to say, you know, we're too important for this. Don't dent our trading relationship. There's a foreign policy element to it. And so I think, within the next week or two, Trump's advisors are saying he's going to sign this formal order. So there's still scope for him to change his mind.
Interesting. Now, Sarah, just to return to the EU for a minute and sort of the real possibility that there could be some retaliatory measures. I mean, as you mentioned, there's the possible $3.5 billion in levies on certain U.S. products. It seems also that they're sort of brushing off their playbook from 2002 when President George W. Bush slapped some tariffs on steel then, right? Because they also at that time, they tried to protect the EU from steel dumping if it was kept out of closed U.S. markets. And they were even talking about floating a challenge to the United States at the World Trade Organization. I mean, could things go that far this time around?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the WTO is the natural forum for something like this to play out and to potentially, although it takes years, potentially stop it from escalating to a dire situation economically for the world. That's the place where this is supposed to play out. What is interesting is that Trump yesterday sort of dangled in front of Canada and Mexico the opportunity, the incentive, as he called it, or as his trade rep called it, to avoid these tariffs if they signed a NAFTA deal. They're negotiating the deal right now. It was a U.S.-led initiative to even reopen NAFTA. And basically, the list of demands are all the U.S.'s on changing this deal. So Trump said, you sign the deal with, you know, in our benefit, and we'll drop these tariffs against you. And I think it's important to point out that if Trump is actually imposing the tariffs in the first place on national security grounds by offering an exemption for trade, you know, a trade deal, that sort of undermines his argument that it's a threat to national security, and that might affect how the challenge goes down at the WTO.
Right. So let me ask you a little bit more about that. So, yeah, he might be undermining his reasoning, this national security reasoning, for slapping these tariffs on steel and aluminum, if it, indeed that does happen. But is it also possible that really perhaps using tariffs as leverage in the NAFTA negotiations may be his end game? I mean, what if the goal is for the United States to try and get, I don't know, Mexico to raise its wages for Mexican steel workers, thereby maybe, you know, again, when the talk about fair trade happens, it's free and fair trade all at the same time. Could NAFTA really be the end game here?
I think that both Canada and Mexico, at least publicly, are saying, you know, this is a no-go for us. This is a free trade deal. This NAFTA is a deal about breaking down these, duties, and steel and aluminum is a separate issue, and it's not covered entirely by the agreement anyway. So why would we start having these are two different tracks, and why would we muddle the two of them? I think that what's actually quite interesting is that, you know, China's voice on all of this has actually been quite mute. The U.S. has a number of cases even related to certain types of aluminum products, aluminum foil, that are going through the WTO right now. And so those are sort of the normal routes, I think, that these issues have been aired before. The administration has sort of targeted China as the main culprit of all this, we haven't heard a lot of response from China yet. Mm-hmm. And the responses have been more proportionate to the direct impact that it could have. Places like Canada, for instance, which is the biggest supplier of steel and aluminum to the U.S.
Right. We get 16% of our steel from Canada. Right.
Exactly. And I think that is sort of amplifying the argument that Trump and the administration's using a really big hammer to really get at a you know, a smaller problem, and it's probably missing the point here.
Now, Sarah, I want to acknowledge that your moment of silence in thinking about my question was eloquent in the fact that perhaps I was reaching there for a NAFTA leverage as a reason for these tariffs. So, Sarah McGregor, a U.S. economics editor for Bloomberg News, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's get another voice in here. Let's turn to Leo Gerard. He's international president of the United Steelworkers, North America's largest manufacturing union, joining us today from Pittsburgh. Leo Gerard, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Okay, so what is your take here? You represent steelworkers. Are you in support of these tariffs?
Well, look, absolutely. But let me back up a bit. There's a long history to this. And I'll go back to when President Clinton was leaving office at the end of his two terms. He wrote a letter to the Commerce Department and said that it was important that Commerce conduct an investigation into the unfair trade of steel in America, and that American steel industry has been under attack for 30 years by unfair traders. That was when President Clinton left, and the onslaught hasn't stopped. In fact, part of my concern with what President Trump has done is that he's not putting enough effort on the cheaters, the unfair traders. And the response by the certain academics and certainly all the Republican eggheads that the reality is that America has, over the period of time since China joined the WTO, America has almost $7 to $8 trillion, depending on which economist you suspect, of accumulated trade debt.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History. A dramatic new 6-part series, narrated by Liam Neeson, that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy, to struggles with corruption, to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history, and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. There are lots of places to debate today's issues if you don't mind getting attacked for speaking your mind or asking a simple question. But 1A is different. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the possibility of tariffs on steel and aluminum, and therefore the possibility of a trade war. Bring it on, says the President of the United States, but a lot of his allies and many industries right here in the United States are not so sure. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined today by Leo Gerard. He's international president of the United Steelworkers. That's North America's largest manufacturing union. And before the break, Mr. Gerard, I take your point. You were talking about what you see as sort of a long-term informal trade war that's been going on in the steel industry.
I wouldn't call it informal by any stretch of the imagination. There's been a formal trade war going on.
With the artificially cheap steel.
And it's been constant with China, South Korea, Russia, and the 12 major cheating countries that President Trump that Wilbur Ross, I should say, identified in his report. And the reality is this. I am personally institutionally concerned when, in particular, Republican members of Congress think that we should just keep doing what we've been doing. As I started to say before the break, that China's accumulated almost a $7 to $8 trillion trade deficit over the years since joining the WTO. South Korea's got a $100 billion trade deficit since the trade deal with them. Mexico has almost a $700 billion trade deficit. Canada has a trade deficit with 35 American states, and U.S. has a trade surplus in Canada with steel, and aluminum is part of a NORAD NATO strategic metals arrangement with Canada.
Mr. Gerard, let me just jump in here. Forgive me for interrupting you, but since you've mentioned Canada a couple times, if I understand correctly, you represent steelworkers in Canada as well.
We represent workers in both countries and the Caribbean.
So how are you balancing that in terms of the U.S. tariffs?
I'll give you the answer.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that our position has been for quite some time that both Canada and the United States have a balanced trade arrangement, whether it's in steel or generally in manufactured goods. Canada and the United States both have got an onslaught of unfairly traded steel and other products from the countries that cheat systematically. So our view is, as the president identified in one, or excuse me, as Wilbur Ross identified in one of his recommendations, that America should go after those countries that cheat. Part of the problem here is that while Republicans keep scaring people with a trade war, what are American workers expected to do when China has a annual trade deficit in durable goods of between $350 billion and $400 billion of annual trade debt? A trade debt is nothing but a wealth transfer.
Mr. Gerard, I understand you're saying I just want to ask you about, I don't necessarily want to talk over each other. So forgive me for doing this, but
you interrupt me all the time.
Well, you've said a couple of very interesting things. I just want to explore them a little bit further here. So first of all, since you mentioned China, I mean, the United States, China sends us 2% of our steel imports, and that's an equivalent of 0.1% of the steel that China manufactures. So I'm just wondering, I mean, it's such a diminishingly small amount.
It's certainly not a diminishing amount.
From China's point of view, 0.1%, it's like they could just brush off these tariffs. Well, I don't think they're going to, but
let me make
how effective
point.
Are they going to be if China is really, if you see the main
clear.
Culprit?
The using percentages doesn't tell the story. Here's the deal. China produces almost 700 million tons, maybe 600 million tons, depends which number you use, more steel than they can consume. So when they say that they're sending you only 1% of their steel, it's 1% of 1.25 billion tons a year. And so they're 1% almost equal to the American industry. The American industry 15 years ago produced about 130 million tons. The American industry now produces about 85 million tons, with China and other countries like South Korea and Brazil and the countries that we've identified as cheaters sent into America. So that, and by the way, the issue between Canada and the United States is that on one year Canada will have a deficit, another year America will have a deficit, but they're generally within range of each other, depending on what's going on, in particular in the auto industry. So that China, over the last 15 years, participated in five what they call high-level meetings. They started off at 500 million tons because they still had overcapacity. Through those five high-level meetings, China promised every time to reduce their capacity so they wouldn't destroy the market.
Mm-hmm.
They now make 1.25 million tons, and they're destroying the market.
So
when you talk about 1% of 1.25 billion tons, that's a serious number.
Yeah, it's 0.1% is what I was saying. But can I get to something a little bit deeper here? Well, actually, Mr. Gerard, I want to get to a deeper issue because you're absolutely right about the slow, long-term contraction of the steel industry in the United States. There's no doubt about that. No debate about that whatsoever. But I'm wondering what you think about this notion that perhaps tariffs are a short-term Band-Aid that's not going to fix a long-term problem. Because I'm thinking of, you know, like last year, there was an article that the Wall Street Journal wrote where they went inside a steel plant. This one happened to be in Austria. And that plant in 2017 needed only 14 workers to make 500,000 tons of steel wire per year. Now, in the 1960s, a similar plant would have taken 1,000 workers. So the point being that we have trade, but we also have technology that's radically changing the industry and reducing the number of workers required.
You're missing the point. America, just listen to my number, made 135 million tons 15 years ago, make 85 now. Who took up that market? Chinese, Japanese, South Koreans, and America and Canada both can make a ton of steel at about one man hour per ton, the most efficient steel industry in the world. In China, you get three times as much carbon as you do in America.
So are you saying that technology doesn't play a role here at all in terms of the contraction of the labor force in the steel industry?
Technology doesn't play a role in reducing from 135 million tons to 85 million tons. Certainly technology played a role because 15 years ago we had probably 2.5 to 3 man hours per ton, and now we're down to about 1 man hour per ton. So our members work in the most efficient steel industry on the planet, the most environmentally sensitive steel industry on the planet, and we're getting killed by Chinese. And so the question I keep having is when you've got this huge trade deficit with these countries, and workers are asking their government to step in and do something about the unfair trade, you got all the Republican Congress saying, no, don't do anything. Well, should we keep having China do what it's doing and continue to have it have a $300 to $400 billion a year trade deficit as they destroy our industrial base, not just our steel industry, but all kinds of other manufacturing stuff that they're attacking on? And at some point, America has to stand up for its own workers.
Mr. Gerard, I have to say, I deeply appreciate your engagement on this issue because obviously it's of intense importance. You've mentioned Republican members of Congress a couple of times. I just want to play a quick piece of tape here. This is Republican Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. He was on Fox News last week, really objecting to the president's plan to impose tariffs on aluminum and steel imports. Here he is.
Trade is great for America. Trade is great for American families, and no trade war has ever worked. We don't want to make America 1930 again, and the forgotten men and women of America don't want to be drafted into a trade war. It doesn't work. Trade creates jobs. All the data shows that, and trade lowers prices for American families. Trade wars do the opposite.
Mr. Gerard, I want to take a couple calls here really quickly, but do you have a quick response to that?
A quick response to that is this, that The reality is that we're in a trade war with the countries that have been identified in Wilbur Ross's report as being the countries that consistently cheat. And when you have an accumulated trade debt of several trillion, or you have an annual trade deficit of almost $3 to $4 billion, $100 billion a year, then you need to respond. And not responding will give us a long-term erosion and destruction of the steel industry, long-term erosion and destruction of our industrial base. And we have to step in, and the government has to step in and say, we're prepared to trade, but you got to be fair and you got to quit cheating.
Well, you're listening to Leo Gerard. He's international president of the United Steelworkers, North America's largest manufacturing union. We are talking about tariffs, trade, and trade wars in steel and aluminum. A couple of quick calls here. Richard is calling from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air, Richard.
Hi, Magna. This is Richard. We manufacture aluminum frontline products for the battlefield, so folding splints and things like that. And what we've seen is from Friday of last week to till this week, just in domestic aluminum, and first off, trying to find domestic aluminum in the U.S. is an impossibility because everyone's trying to get foreign aluminum in here. If you're trying to create a product for the government that adheres to the Berry Amendment, where it's all U.S. made, all the components, everything else, it's a near impossibility.
Yeah.
So we've instantly hit a more than 20% price increase between the time we ordered aluminum and the time we need to replace that order. As a small business, the question is, can we pass that on to the government, and are they going to be willing to pay it?
Richard, really, really interesting question here. And you're also pointing to the fact that that American businesses that rely on steel and aluminum imports is 40 times larger than the steel industry itself. I want to take another quick call here.
Okay,
Wes is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Wes, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Trump's tariff tantrum will actually have the opposite effect on the high-tech manufacturing that we so desperately need to grow in this country. Here's how. Take Harley-Davidson, as you mentioned. Their engines are roughly 90% aluminum. The frames are 100% steel. So if I'm Harley-Davidson, rather than see my raw materials cost increase, I'm going to consider manufacturing my engines and frames in Mexico or Canada, because only raw aluminum and steel are subject to this tariff. But I'd avoid the tariffs by importing finished engines and frames. So tariffs on aluminum and steel won't help our mills when the entire factories move abroad, skipping U.S. aluminum and steel altogether. In order for tariffs to be effective, we need to have tariffs on everything. Face it, some types of industries aren't coming back to the United States. Adding tariffs on raw materials is playing trade deficit whack-a-mole.
Now, Leo Gerard, I know that you wanted to get in there, and I will allow you to respond here in just a second, but I have another guest that I'd like to bring into the conversation first. Matthew Slaughter, he's dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. He's also a professor of international business. He is a former member of the Council of Economic Advisors in the administration of President George W. Bush. Matthew Slaughter, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, Magna.
So you've been hearing a lot here. I'm just wondering sort of take us to fundamentals here. What's your take about the effectiveness of tariffs if the goal is to preserve jobs in the steel and aluminum industry in the United States?
So no country wins a trade war. All countries lose. Your colleague West just pointed out the complexity of how companies respond to these new tariffs. It might be the case that some U.S. companies and their employees who make steel and aluminum will gain from the higher U.S. prices. But these gains will surely be swamped by much larger losses by at least a couple of groups. All the metals-consuming companies and their workers who are going to be rendered less competitive by these higher input prices. And all the companies and all the workers across the economy, as you said earlier in your show, whose exports are going to be hit by retaliatory tariffs levied by even our trade partners like the EU. I think the deeper issue that Mr. Gerard rightly points out, and I think the president is earnestly thinking about, is how are we going to support more American workers and their families and their communities to have good jobs and a greater sense of opportunity? That's an important question. Building new tariffs and starting a trade war is going to do the exact opposite from the desire to help American workers and their families.
And yet this is something that other presidents have used in the past. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about how in 2002, President George W. Bush, whom you know you advised, also for about a year or so slapped some tariffs on steel. I mean, how did that turn out in terms of meeting that goal of trying to support American workers in the industry?
Not well. A lot of good research has shown that the cost to the U.S. economy per job that was temporarily supported by those tariffs was several hundred thousand U.S. dollars. So I think that the question is, how could we build, rather than walls, ladders of opportunity for American workers and their companies? So supporting certain types of workers is a terrific goal, but we as a country should be thinking much more broadly. The forces of trade, the forces, as you rightly pointed out, about technological change, those are going to continue to transform whole companies and whole industries. So I think the right policy question is, what should we do to support American workers to be equipped for all this dynamism, which has been present for generations and will be present for the future?
Right. So this gets to the point about are the kinds of trade deficits we have right now, are they the sort that basically ends up subtracting demand from the American domestic economy and do form a kind of anchor on our own growth? Or should we be looking at trade, the deficits in the broader term, that basically the American economy is stronger and more wealthy, so therefore we can buy more than we sell abroad?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the broader perspective is the right one. We should keep in mind that the United States today is basically at full employment. There's always a bit of structural unemployment with people switching jobs or moving in and out of school. So we ran a trade deficit last year with the rest of the world of about $800 billion. That overall trade deficit reflects the fact that we as a country, we had too little savings relative to the capital investment that our companies were undertaking to the tune of about $800 billion. So there's sometimes this fiction that if we closed off to that trade deficit to the rest of the world, that dollar for dollar would magically increase output and jobs in America. But that's not the economics of how it works.
I'm going to turn back here for a second to Leo Gerard. Mr. Gerard, we have about 30 seconds before we have to take a break here. But Matthew Slaughter was talking about acknowledging that the effects of these trade deficits do disproportionately hit certain industries, especially manufacturing, a point you were making earlier.
Look, at here's the, try to keep it simple. Again, on aluminum, we had 15 smelters 15 years ago. We're now down to 4 or 5. That's why that first caller can't find domestic aluminum. And the reality is you got to deal with the reality that these countries that cheat, and keep in mind, if you got to cheat to be in business, you're in the wrong business. These countries that cheat, I'll use China again as an example, but it's an example that would apply to all of them. Hmm. China decided that it would dominate the solar panel market worldwide, and they said, even if we have to sell under the cost of production.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We're talking about tariffs and trade wars. And today we're speaking with Leo Gerard. He's international president of the United Steelworkers, and also with Matthew Slaughter, dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College and former member of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. Now, during a press conference this morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan talked about this issue. He does not like the idea of heavy-handed tariffs and proposed a more nuanced approach.
There is clearly abuse occurring. Clearly, there is overcapacity, dumping, and transshipping of steel and aluminum by some countries, particularly China. But I think the smarter way to go is to make it more surgical and more targeted.
Matthew Slaughter, can we do that, surgical, targeted tariffs?
We can. The right way to do that, and the way we and other countries have done it in the past, is through the World Trade Organization. That's been around for decades, and there's a adjudication process if a country has a legitimate concern that they can bring to the WTO. And I think it's important to stress that we as a country have gained immensely from participation in the WTO and its predecessor, the GATT. The trade liberalization that have gone on for decades under the GATT and more recently the WTO have on net created more jobs in America, helped raise average wages in America. And so I think it's important for us to keep in mind us moving outside of the usual adjudication mechanisms like the WTO invites other countries to do the same thing and break down the whole system.
Well, let me ask you, though, because, I mean, the notion, yes, Mr. Gerard, I will get to you. But the notion that that free trade is the rising tide that lifts all boats, I mean, there's another, if you turn that on its head, I mean, there have been some studies, I was looking at one from a couple years ago, 2011 study, that said, that found that the cost of imbalanced trade with low-wage countries cost U.S. workers who don't have a college degree about 5.5% of their annual earnings over time. I mean, that's not insignificant. That's, what, two-thirds of the U.S. workforce.
You're definitely right that trade does not directly benefit every single worker and family and community. The same thing is true of technological change and innovation. So I think the bigger issue that our country faces right now is what set of policies could we create and properly fund and structure that would give more American workers a chance to climb up those ladders of opportunity, to gain the skills, the retraining, the mobility that's going to allow them to be prepared for the kinds of jobs in the 21st century that are being created today.
Leo Gerard?
Three quick responses to this.
If I may, I'm afraid we don't have time for three because I want to get our callers in here as well.
Well, if she gave me as much time as the others, it'd be all right.
Well, you had a third of the show here all to yourself when it was just you and me, sir.
Interrupting me. Could I just tell you that the fact of the matter is that lots of these things are just wrong. We're talking about stopping the cheating. And you can't say that we can have a competitive environment when one country, two countries, three countries deliberately cheat so that they can take our market. And if you look at the industries we're talking about, steel, aluminum, solar panels, they have decided to deliberately go under the cost of production to destroy our market, destroy our jobs. That's number one. Two, we've had more losses than wins at the WTO. Three, workers' average wages are equal now to what they were in 1975. That's what unfair trade has done. when you're talking about a company that has to compete with Mexico, where Mexican wages are $3 an hour, or a country that has to compete with China, where the wages is maybe $2 an hour, and they deliberately create overcapacity so that they can flood the market and cheat and sell under the cost of production. So if we don't deal with the real underlying issues, we'll keep finding that we lose our industrial base.
Mm.
And when it comes to aluminum, aluminum is now a strategic material that is designed as an alliance with NATO and NORAD and America and Canada. So when we lose 15 smelters because the Chinese have built 32 smelters in the last 15 years so they could collect over the capacity and destroy our market. That's the reality we have to deal with, not a bunch of economic make-believe that the way the world could be.
Matthew Slaughter, do you have a response to that?
Mr. Jarrett is definitely right that average wages in America, especially for full-time year-round working males, are about today where they were in the early 1970s. So that should be a fact that we all start from. There are hundreds of policy and academic studies that have shown the force that is contributing most to no wage growth for too many Americans is technology innovation, technological change, and capital investment that favors more skilled workers over less skilled workers. So if we're going to focus time and energy, as we should, on this fundamentally important question, the important thing to think about is how do we prepare workers for the dynamism of the world economy that's just not going to go away? There's only about 1 in 10 Americans today that when they wake up, they go to work in manufacturing. And there have been, again, hundreds of studies that show the biggest force that changes the nature of jobs in America is technology innovation. Yeah. So in steel, a lot of what's
actually, Mr. Gerard and Mr. Slaughter, both of you, gentlemen, my number one job here right now is to be sure that I create space for some of our very patient callers. And so I'm going to just go ahead and do that. Let's turn to John, who's calling from Detroit. You're on the air, John. John. Hi, John. You there?
Hi, Magnus. So my opinion is this: there are a lot of problems, there are a lot of issues, including that we treat other countries as our slaves to produce products cheaply for us. But the real issue here is the way that this president has presented this in such an offensive, warmongering terms, and if he was truly interested in solving this, he would not go like this. He would do it defensively. He would list the reasons why this is good, and he would listen to some of his advisors.
Right.
I truly believe that this is yet just another smokescreen, a diversion from other issues that are bombarding this president. So he thought this was the opportune time to start a trade war.
John, I'm going to jump in there. Thank you so much for your call, because I want to turn now to Jeffrey, who's calling from Harrogate, Tennessee. You're on the air, Jeffrey.
Hi, Magna.
Hi, Jeffrey. What's your thought today?
My thought is I'm actually from the Steel Belt area. I'm not originally from Tennessee, and so it is a Rust Belt, and a lot of people, they don't see what I saw growing up as far as the decline. My father worked in a steel mill, and we grew up in a town of 5,000 people, and the industry that was there was railroad cars, and the company was Trinity Industries. They had 1,500 people. They shut it down. They moved the plant to Mexico, and if you take 1,500 people out of a population of 5,000, you know, this is in the 90s, it's a huge problem, and you see it in Youngstown, mm-hmm. I mean Detroit, all these things, and I think that the tariffs are going to help, and I think that Trump in this case, I give him credit, because I think you see the Republicans are giving him pushback on it,
right?
And I think he's actually splitting away from the Republicans and being a little more fair, because I think a lot of the Republicans are probably getting money from a lot of these huge companies.
Jeffrey, forgive me for interrupting you, because I know you've been waiting for a while. I just wanted to say thank you so much for your call. And I'm afraid we're actually going to have to end our main conversation with that. Leo Gerard, International President of the United Steelworkers, that's North America's largest manufacturing union.
Mr. Girard, I really do thank you so very much for your time today. And Matthew Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. He's also a former member of the Council of Economic Advisors in the George W. Bush administration. Dean Slaughter, thank you so very much.
Thanks very much, Magda.
All right, in just a moment, we're going to ask what the big battles will be for economies of the future. This is On Point. Well, here's a question. Obviously, there's a great deal of passion and deep feeling about these trade battles over steel and aluminum production. But maybe if we think bigger, we have to wonder if the battles are worth having. Are these industries the ones that you might call the commanding heights of the economy of the future? Well, joining me now from Washington is Nicholas Lardy, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Nicholas, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Okay, so, I mean, answer that question. Is this the battle worth having if we're thinking about structuring America's economy for the future?
Well, I think one has to begin by recognizing that, you know, the manufacturing share of total output in the United States has been declining quite significantly for, you know, actually since the 1950s. We have become more and more a service economy that now is responsible for almost three-quarters of output. So the long-term trend is very clear. Manufacturing is less important to the overall economy. It's less important to the welfare of people in the United States than it was decades ago. We will still have a manufacturing sector. I'm not saying it's going to zero. But it's not the dominant force of growth in innovation that it had been in the couple of decades after World War II.
Well, so does that explain then why a little earlier this hour we were talking about how thus far China has been remarkably or relatively quiet in all this in reacting to the proposed tariffs by the President of the United States?
Well, I think the reality is one that was you mentioned earlier on the program, and that is China exports almost no steel to the United States. Chinese steel exports to the United States have been under very heavy restriction for quite a few years. So their share in our market has gone to a teeny, teeny number. It's 2% of our imports of steel, but it's much less than that as a share of total steel consumption in the United States. So certainly the first reason China isn't reacting is that high tariffs on steel are going to have no significant effect on their economy. What they are worried about is a much more far-reaching set of protectionist measures that President Trump has also promised to take under the so-called Section 301. This deals with intellectual property and particularly the question of forced technology transfer. It is widely believed that many American companies that wanted to invest in China, to operate in China, to sell into that market were forced to transfer very advanced technology that has then gradually been absorbed by Chinese companies, and they have in effect done a shortcut. They have borrowed, shall we say, in quotation marks, they borrowed the technology from the United States.
So, Nicholas Lardy, let me ask you, because I think this is vitally important to talk about, because as we move towards an ever more digital economy in the future, really the products of value are intellectual property. So, you know, earlier in the hour, we were hearing Mr. Girard talk about cheating when it comes to the steel industry. I mean, when you put borrowed in quotes that China borrowed U.S. intellectual property, I mean, is there cheating going on with IP and China? And is that where the future trade wars are going to be?
Well, there's certainly some cheating in that domain. It's very difficult, however, to precisely measure it. And many companies have used technology as a bargaining chip in their negotiation to get into the market. To get into the market, they've said, we'll provide this technology if you give us access to your market. So a lot of this technology transfer is more voluntary than forced, although in a few cases, there is some force. You could say, if you wanted to be literal, you could say there's no forced technology transfer. No U.S. high-tech company has to manufacture in China or do business in China. They can always just choose to stay out. rather than being forced to transfer their technology. So you could say at one level,
I mean, you could say that, but they're soon to be the largest market in the world.
Yeah, well, that's an advantage that they have. Countries always use their advantages to enhance their own position. So, yes, I think there is forced technology transfer. All I'm saying is measuring it with any precision is extremely difficult, if not impossible. But the amount of forced technology transfer or the violation of intellectual property under any definition is huge. And there are two things about the Section 301. First of all, it would target a much, much broader range of industries in China. It would not be based on cheating or selling below cost or illegal subsidies from the Chinese government. And the second thing is that Section 301 protection would be applied exclusively against China. Mm-hmm. We're not accusing Canada or other countries of engaging in these kinds of practices. So I think China's playing very low-key on steel. Of course, they're waiting to see if Trump actually does anything and what the details will be. But it isn't going to affect them. And they're more worried about what might happen under Section 301, which for them could be much, much more far-reaching and would single them out as the only target of protection imposed by the United States.
It sounds like it could be massive. And I guess that makes me wonder. I mean, some people have been critical of President Trump for using, you know, that 1962 law that points to national security as a reason to levy tariffs in the case of steel and aluminum. But I wonder, I mean, when we're talking about data and technology and intellectual property, I think you can make a stronger national defense protectionism argument in those cases. Can you not?
I think absolutely. And protection of intellectual.
Nicholas Lardy, you still there?
The protection of intellectual property is provided for in the WTO. And the national security provision is, as you mentioned, rarely used. Any kind of, I mean, one of the reasons we want to avoid using that rationale is any country could say any product is important for national security and adopt protectionist measures. It would probably be challenged in the WTO. Protection of intellectual property is something that China has signed up for when it joined the WTO, and it has been the subject of ongoing negotiations with the United States for, more than 10 years as we've tried to get them to come into compliance with their obligations. So, and again, in response to China's continued violations, we can put tariffs on any product we want. Hmm. It's complete free choice on the part of the administration as to which products they would target.
Right. Well, so it looks like the bigger action on trade may be yet to come. Nicholas Lardy, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and author of several books on China, including Markets Over Mao, The Rise of Private Business in China. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And by the way, listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.